Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news, and we'll begin and speak about the so-called stress tests that the biggest banks underwent and allegedly passed. We'll be joined by Nomi Prince, who's an author, journalist, and senior fellow at Demos. She is the author of Other People's Money, The Corporate Mugging of America, Jacked, How Conservatives Are Picking Your Pockets, Whether You Voted for Them or Not, and a novel, The Trial. Before becoming a journalist, Nomi Prince worked on Wall Street as a managing director at Goldman Sachs and running the International Analytics Group at Bear Stearns in London. Her articles have appeared in the New York Times, Fortune, Newsdays, Mother Jones, Slate.com, and The Guardian in the United Kingdom. Her forthcoming book to be released this fall is It Takes a Pillage, Behind the Bonuses, Bailouts, and Backroom Deals from Washington to Wall Street. And she also has an article in the current issue of Mother Jones, Flunking the Stress Test, Why the Long-Awaited Results Are Meaningless. And then as the 20th anniversary of the massacre in Tiananmen Square approaches, we will look into how the Chinese government is clamping down to prevent any revival of democratic protests in remembrance of what the Chinese government refers to as a political disturbance. And then we will examine the GOP's secret cabal of gay-bashing, closeted Republicans in leadership positions who publicly preach family values while privately leading secret lives. We'll be joined by Kirby Dick, the Academy Award-nominated documentary filmmaker. His new film, Outrage, is just open to rave reviews, and we'll be talking to him about the content of his film. And in Outrage, the openly gay Democratic Congressman Barney Frank of Massachusetts explains that his Republican colleagues have a right to privacy, but no right to hypocrisy. I'm now speaking with Nomi Prince, who is an author, journalist, and senior fellow at Demos. She is the author of Other People's Money, The Corporate Mugging of America, Jacked, How Conservatives Are Picking Your Pocket, Whether You Voted for Them or Not, and a novel, The Trial. And before becoming a journalist, Nomi worked on Wall Street as a managing director at Goldman Sachs, and she ran International Analytics Group at Bear Stearns in London. And her latest book is It Takes a Pillage, Behind the Bonuses, Bailouts, and Backroom Deals from Washington to Wall Street. That'll be out in the fall. And there's a current article of hers in Mother Jones, Flunking the Stress Test, Why the Long-Awaited Results Are Meaningless. And Nomi, one of the things that I find so extraordinarily puzzling about the situation we're in is I keep wondering where is the outrage and where is the populist revolt in this country, given the fact that just last week in the Senate failed to pass a rather modest proposal that would allow people who are facing foreclosure, who got these liar's loans and were in many ways deceived by the banks and lenders into taking these loans. The banking lobby weighed in to the point where Senator Dick Durbin said that the U.S. Senate, the banks own the U.S. Senate. And this modest proposal that would allow bankruptcy judges to allow people to stay in their homes and continue to service their mortgages was voted down by the pressure from the banks, who themselves would be in bankruptcy, but for the taxpayer who's bailing them out.
It's enraging and so very sad at the same time. And in terms of the public outrage, I think what Washington has been very good at doing, and when I say Washington, I think it's a cross between Congress, but also the Treasury Department and the Federal Reserve, has just been able to change the message of what the bailout and all of these trillions of dollars, which were not just actual capital that was given to the banks, it was that too, but it was also all of these cheap loans that the Fed has given to the banking industry to, yes, keep it afloat and keep it from bankruptcy, and for them to have the nerve to complain about helping individuals, which, by the way, would help them too. That's the sad and ironic part. The enraging part is the money that the industry has been getting at the expense of those same people who are facing foreclosure and all of the rest of us who might not be. And the sad part is really that they dare to complain about something that would also help them. It's an incredibly convoluted situation, and we should be far more outraged. And I think what has been incredibly secretive in terms of these groups in Washington is the idea of how much the bailout really has accreted to. It isn't just a $700 billion from the Treasury. It isn't even the $3 trillion that the Treasury Department itself released a report about 2 weeks ago. It's about $13 trillion. And it's real loans and real money, and that money could actually buy up every single mortgage in this country, have about $3 trillion left over to buy up homes for anyone else who doesn't have them, and that would not only help everybody and the economy, it would actually help the banks from continuing to post losses on securities that contain these loans.
But explain this to me and the audience, if you will, Nomi. How could it be that in our capitalist system, which for so long we've been told to celebrate the free market and the forces of market capitalism and how it has its own logic and perfection and beauty and whatever, and the idea that a small group of people lost $13 trillion in a system that's supposed to be inherently have checks and balances and be transparent. And if you fail, you go into bankruptcy. That's been the system. If you win, you win. If you lose, you lose.
Right.
They've created a system where you can lose $13 trillion. Imagine what any government in any country in the world could do with $13 trillion, not to mention the United States government. We could create a paradise here in America for every average American with that kind of money. It's all evaporated.
Well, exactly. I mean, that $13 trillion is money that's evaporated into the system in just 8 months. I mean, we're talking about money that's been lent or given to the industry in the last 8 months. This doesn't even count what they've lost. This is what we've, as a federal government, given to the industry to keep them in survival mode. And it's completely not capitalist. It's completely not a free market competitive idea of, you know, the strong win, which, you know, is something that's actually quite prevalent within the different firms in Wall Street, and the weak get dissolved or destroyed. It's nothing like that. It's sort of like the stronger actually get to become bigger, and the bigger actually get to become less stable. The Federal Reserve had an opportunity to make up for all of their lack of regulation and monitoring that created this situation back in the fall when things were really falling apart in the industry and there were bankruptcies. Lehman Brothers was one. It's the biggest bankruptcy that our country's ever experienced historically. And the world didn't fall apart after that happened. The Fed lent a lot of money to give to Lehman's creditors, which, back to what you were saying in the beginning of the show, is something that's not happening even at all with respect to bankruptcy laws and people facing foreclosure. It did happen with Lehman Brothers. But also the Fed, rather than taking the opportunity to fix or remonitor or make more manageable to monitor the banking industry, decided to instead approve more mergers within it. The Fed's never not approved a merger in the last 30 years, and it's approved many in the last part of 2008, all of which create bigger institutions that, given the system that they are operating in and given the policy of Washington at the moment, which doesn't seem to be undergoing any sort of change or introspection, will keep on extorting more public money to keep them in survival mode, and when they screw up later, because they have become bigger and they are riskier even than they were going into this period, will only happen again in a bigger fashion.
So let's try and get a picture here of the full scope of this financial disaster. I understand, and you corrected me a second ago, I understand that the stock market has lost about $9 trillion.
Yes.
The housing market has lost $5.5 trillion. And then on top of that, $13 trillion of taxpayers' monies has poured in to staunch these losses. So you're talking about $27 trillion here.
Yeah, and another about $3 trillion for the retirement funds and pension funds that were partially invested in the stock market, but also involved in some of these actually toxic assets that devalue them as well. So you're actually talking about $30 trillion, and that's just in the United States.
So that's the 401ks you're talking about, right?
Correct, the 401ks and some of the pension funds, like the state pension mm-hmm. funds that bought into some of these securities that were created by Wall Street leading into this disaster that have no value and also lost the money in addition to their investments in the stock market.
But we were told, at least these are the arguments that were made in the Congress when they overturned the Glass-Steagall Act under the Clinton administration. We were told that they needed this lack of transparency in order to be competitive. And now we have a situation where they have been able to lose $30 trillion in the dark, and suddenly and nobody knew about it until it all caught up on us. And now we're stuck in the hole, and now they're telling us, well, we're too big to fail, and you just have to dance to our tune. And meanwhile, these irresponsible oligarchs who have destroyed the global economy are being rewarded and made stronger.
Yes.
A hell of a deal, isn't it?
It's phenomenal. They've been made stronger. They've been rewarded. They've maintained their secrecy. And Washington, you know, particularly the Fed and the Treasury, have been complicit in all of this. They've been complicit in not just maintaining the status quo, but really making it worse for the future. And that's where, you know, outrage should be directed. It should be directed at the Fed. It should be directed at the Treasury, as well as at Congress. When Glass-Steagall was created in 1933, it was after a lot of shady practices by the banks and a lot of debt that was created on the back of nothing that went into various trusts and the stock market and everywhere else, and a lot of it was fabricated, and it did unhinge the banking system, and FDR came in with a Treasury secretary who happened to have been just as connected to the corporate world as was Hank Paulson and is Tim Geithner, and he was a Republican, and he even owned stock in J.P. Morgan at the time, which ultimately was why he had to resign. But for a year, that Treasury Secretary and FDR and the Congress put together a reform, the Glass-Steagall Act, that dissected the banking industry into manageable parts. The banks that were commercial banks that dealt with consumer deposits and loans, and those were backed by the government, the deposits as well as the practices, and then the more speculative investment banks, which just simply weren't. And that was very free market, and that was actually very in the idea of capitalism, as well as in the idea of restraining bad capitalism from hurting the rest of the country. And it worked very, very well for decades. We didn't have the kind of catastrophic results in the banking industry when they failed that then spilled into the general economy. We had the S&L crisis in the late 80s, but that was really dwarfed by the losses that, like hugely dwarfed by the losses that have happened now. And what we've had in between was that dissolution of the Glass-Steagall Act by a 90-8 vote in Congress. I mean, this was a totally bipartisan, you know, Clinton administration, Republican Senate, totally combined act of complete decimation of the stability of the financial system, and we're kind of living in the results right now.
Well, I think that sort of leads us, Naomi Prince, to the conclusion that Senator Dick Durbin announced in frustration the other day that the banks own the Congress, because, as you point out, it's bipartisan. The only thing that I can see that would ever change that system is, since the people in Washington represent capital and not people, they're our so-called representatives, at least the majority of them do, and if the banking lobby is as powerful as Dick Durbin says it is, the only thing that will get these politicians off the take from the banks is if the public lights a fire under them.
Yes.
I mean, it's that simple, isn't it?
I think if the public really was able to coordinate, basically make the message very clear, and it's not necessarily through the mainstream media, and it's not necessarily through all of the anger that, you know, happens in the, you know, in individualized locations. It's really just a hammering at Congress people, if there was a way to convince them that their jobs, no matter how much money was going into supporting them by the banking industry, were simply at risk from their decisions. And this was part of what happened in the 30s. There wasn't so much of a... The banking industry certainly controlled a lot back then, and no doubt. It had really run amok. It controlled a lot. It controlled members in Congress as well back then. The difference was there was much more popular anger, and there was much more of a concerted effort between FDR and Glass and Steagall and Wood and the Treasurer and others to do something to stabilize things. And I think people need to really flood Congress, because that will be where the legislation comes from. That is where there can be requests for more transparency in terms of what the Fed is doing, and there has been some with respect to what the Treasury has been doing with this bailout. And just say, look, you know, you are just not going, for what it's worth, to get my vote, and not just 10 of us or 20 of us or a million of us, but like, you know, 100 million of us, to make that clear, that this is just not acceptable. Not that we don't believe you. We don't believe that giving money to this industry helps us in any way. We seriously do not buy it anymore, because we, you know, we shouldn't. It's not true.
Again, I'm speaking with Nomi Prince, author of a new book coming out in the fall, It Takes a Pillage, Behind the Bonuses, Bailouts, and Backroom Deals from Washington to Wall Street. She also has an article in the current issue of Mother Jones, Flunking the Stress Test, Why the Long-Awaited Results Are Meaningless. So now we're left with trying to figure out here, Nomi, what's going on in the political realm, having discussed the dysfunction how the politicians were enabled this disaster, and how the people on Wall Street ran away with the ball, kept us in the dark until there's a $30 trillion hole in the economy, and all this wealth has evaporated, and we're apparently totally in their hands, and there's nothing we can do about it except keep pouring money, good money after bad. That's about where we're at. So presumably President Obama knows some of this stuff. Why is he sort of not wanting to take the lead in what we're talking about, in getting the people of this country sufficiently educated and riled up to force the politicians to start representing them and stop representing the banking lobby? He seems to be very selectively, he decided not to weigh in and help Dick Durbin on the keeping people in their homes and stopping the foreclosures and allowing bankruptcy judges to mediate. He seems to be weighing in on the credit card issue, and he made a speech to that effect. So maybe the banks will be, and the Congress will be forced to do something about that. And there's also a predatory lending bill that was passed by the House on Thursday. But all of those things, both of those have got a long way to go. So explain to me what is going on, if you can, with Obama. He must know what's really going on. At the same time, it looks like the people around him, one, are in many ways responsible for the mess that we're in, and two, are clearly deeply connected to this kind of group of irresponsible oligarchs who have got us into the trouble in the first place.
Well, you know, the simple answer, and I think, you know, it's been on a lot of our heads as to why Obama might not be taking a stronger stand, is that, you know, despite the public overture under which he became elected president, you know, there was a significant amount of contributions from Wall Street and from the financial sectors. And the corporate sector is like any politician. He had more than that, but without that, it would have been a lot harder to get the funding. And we do, not to say it's all campaign finance is structure's fault, because I think that's too easy an answer. But there is a relationship issue, and I think he wants to stay in power, and it's one of those things where, you know, paralleling back to FDR, FDR came in on a not too much higher than the percentage that Obama won by, a 57% popular vote. It wasn't a full vote on for him, but he came in from a position, you know, running New York, and he came in and he had ties, and he actually used the environment to create a relationship between the Treasury Department and Congress, which allowed him to push things forward. And Obama has instead kind of allowed Tim Geithner to take on a lot of what he had been discussing pre-election about, you know, taking on Wall Street, and or not actually taking it on, but giving the responsibility of dealing with Wall Street and regulations and whatever might come out of it to Geithner, who has zero intention of doing anything like that. And so he's kind of like shifted it, and I think he hopes that by focusing on some things like predatory lending, which is important, and doing something with credit cards, which is important, although you really have to be a lot harder than what's being proposed. There's no reason to have 20% credit cards and all of the higher fees and everything else in this environment. There's no reason for banks not to pay more money for people's savings accounts and rather to hoard it for themselves. And there's no reason for any of that. That can be legislated against. He's not taking that position because I really think he hopes that he can do enough to seem or even be populist with some of the smaller issues that might be more easy to push through because they have some sort of bipartisan support and they sort of deal with more people in terms of them being able to understand the issues. You can understand why your credit card rates are too high. You can understand that you don't want to be screwed over by lenders, no matter whether you were or not in the past. And let the whole fuzzy bank industry stuff kind of hopefully take care of itself and not really spend the political capital to do that. I mean, in a way, he's just, you know, perhaps he's being pragmatic in his role, and then in a larger extent, he's being quite weak.
Well, just to compare him to Roosevelt, and obviously we're not in a comparable situation in the sense that we have a full-blown depression, but it could tip into that.
Well, we have a much greater loss in the system in terms of, you know, comparative monetary loss than we had back then. I know it's not a public depression, but it certainly is a different kind of a loss that's not dissimilar.
But Roosevelt did connect to the people and connected with their populist rage, and he took on the oligarchs. He was quite open about referring to them as malefactors of great wealth. That's the thing about Obama that I guess is the fundamental difference, is that he doesn't want to go there.
No, he's called their practices bad. He's kind of indicated that there's a negative there, but he hasn't really taken them on. He has said that you know, Wall Street's practices should never be allowed to hurt Main Street and all. He says these things, but yeah, it isn't with the same sort of a very sort of tactical, very clear swipe at individuals or at companies or at real practices. You know, he's not honing it into that real easy to follow kind of message. And yes, FDR did do that. I think if Obama did that, it would be popular.
Well, let us, you know, stay tuned here, Naomi. I'm afraid we've run out of time here. But clearly, we're not out of the woods here. And I thank you so much for joining us in Los Angeles.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. Just speaking there with Naomi Prince, author, journalist, and senior fellow at Demos. She previously worked on Wall Street as a managing director at Goldman Sachs, and she ran an international analytics group at Bear Stearns in London. Her forthcoming book is It Takes a Pillage: Behind the Bonuses, Bailouts, and Backroom Deals from Washington to Wall Street. Let's now go to the subject of the 20th anniversary of the Tiananmen Square massacre. I'm speaking with Dr. Perry Link, who was formerly a professor of East Asian Studies at Princeton University and currently holds the Chancellorial Chair for Innovative Teaching across disciplines at the University of California, Riverside, as well as being a professor of comparative literature and foreign language at UCR. Dr. Link is known as one of the Western world's most foremost experts on China, its language, culture, and people. While at Princeton, he edited the Tiananmen Papers with Columbia University's Andrew Nathan, a collection of documents leaked by a high-level Chinese official that helped chronicle the events inside the Politburo that led up to and followed the protest of the reform-minded students in June of 1989. He has translated many Chinese stories, writings, and poems into English, and in 1996, China blacklisted Perry Link and he has been denied entrance there ever since. And of course, as the 20th anniversary of the massacre at Tiananmen Square approaches, Perry Link, it looks as if the Chinese government is trying to preempt any possibility of protests.
Yes, it does. They're being very careful. They're putting under gentle house arrest a number of people whom they think might be the symbols or the spokespeople for a revival of the ideas of 1989, and just keeping a lid on things as well as they can.
And of course, the ideas, what flourished there was a moment of incredible openness, and at a certain moment, it looked as if the students were holding sway. They were confronting these previously faceless people inside the Politburo live on television. Initially, it was the student protests became were galvanized around the death of a popular leader, Hu Yaobang. Premier Zhao Zhang was a relatively tolerant man, and it's China's never seen anything since. It's amazing how the spirit of that moment has been extinguished, but has it been extinguished?
One needs to analyze this by generations. I think the ones that lived through those years, not just in Beijing, but all around the country where there were sympathetic protests, certainly remember. And they certainly know the prohibitions against public expression of anything about it. So they keep quiet. They speak among themselves. They remember, for sure. And it's interesting to note that the government itself are one of the parties who clearly remembers because, as we mentioned just a moment ago, they're very nervous during these times. They call them sensitive periods, and they take extraordinary measures to make sure nothing flares up again. So people do remember. The reason I say, though, that it's generational is that the younger generation, one can't say they don't know about it, but it just has faded immensely. The public education about the event disappears, and when it's mentioned at all, it's referred to in ever-diminishing terms, that is, from a massacre to an incident to a trifle. And one can speak today with very well-educated young people who are internet savvy and all of that, who really have very foggy notions, if at all, about what happened 20 years ago.
Indeed, the official reference is to Tiananmen was a political disturbance, and but the truth of the matter is that hundreds, possibly thousands, of people are believed to have been killed, and there's still an estimated 50 to 200 Tiananmen prisoners still in Chinese jails.
Right, and the number of people who participated at the time was in the millions. At the peak of the demonstrations in Tiananmen Square itself, it's estimated that there were more than 1 million people, and you need to multiply that by about 20 or 30 times to cover the other major cities in China where there were sympathetic demonstrations. And no one knows, of course, but in my estimate, for every person who dared to come out on the streets, there were 10 or a dozen or maybe several dozen who watched from a distance in sympathy. It really was a tremendously large movement, sparked, as you mentioned a moment ago, by the death of this relatively open-minded leader, Hu Yaobang, but really coming from deep protests of many decades standing from inside China about the way corruption, especially, is generated in the governing system. And the in the cities, the work unit system, where a party secretary would have control over virtually every aspect of a young person's life and so on. These kinds of things were longstanding and very widespread. So it is a mistake, I think, and I do think the Western media, not to blame them particularly, but did make this mistake at the time of seeing it as a relatively superficial reaction to Western ideas, the Statue of Liberty and the idea of democracy. And certainly that was there in the banners, but the real upset came from much deeper within China and much more broadly than just that.
Well, indeed, the extent to which the protests were about demanding an end to corruption, and also I believe there was also a sense that the Chinese leadership not only was it harboring and corralling all of the wealth for itself, the country was becoming more and more aware of the higher standard of living in Taiwan and South Korea and other places. So what's interesting now is that after Tiananmen, the government clearly made an effort to distract any notions of democracy by encouraging a new nationalism.
Right.
And they've clearly delivered on the material side, and perhaps the enormous amount of materialism that now is in China is a way to dampen any memories of that. But the issue that lives on, surely, is corruption.
Yes, corruption and inequality. The gap between the rich and poor, as measured by economists, is even greater in China now today than it is in the United States, where it's been getting larger already. And that rankles, because the people at the bottom end of that not only see it as inequality, but as unfair inequality. That is, you people who are connected with the party and have these elite connections can marshal the resources of the economy to your own private wealth in a way that isn't fair to us. We used to be the workers. We used to be the ones that are supposed to own this system. And now our pensions have disappeared because of inflation, and you've made off with the goodies. That kind of perception of inequality is really even more strong than just the fact of corruption per se.
So given that the pervasive nature of the corruption, and we saw examples of it after that earthquake, how people were angry and how they were paid off, and how we constantly learn about Communist Party officials covering up mine disasters, etc. And it seems to me in this you have this peculiar parallel system, which the Soviet Union also had, where you have a government and a party. And it seems still to this day, and in many ways in the Soviet Union before the kind of perestroika glasnost revolution, people referred to the Communist Party in the Soviet Union as a mafia. And I think it's pretty much the same in China, isn't it? It's kind of a mafia. It's not, they're totally unresponsive. And I'm wondering, at what point does the government have more influence than the party? Is that in flux?
I don't really think it is. Now, China scholars generally refer to the party state with a hyphen in between. It's very hard in functional terms to separate the party from the government. Your use of the term mafia there is correct, I think. It's a courageous thing to do. Most people shy away from actually using a word like that. But it is, sociologically speaking, a set of interrelated families who have had power since the revolution, since the late 40s. And if you watch what China's done over those years, it was terribly against capitalism at one point and now is embracing it. There were campaigns to denounce Confucius, and now Confucius is praised. There were times when repression of the Japanese war atrocities was in the 1950s. You couldn't talk about the Nanjing Massacre, and now it's celebrated. So there are all these tremendous reversals of policy, but one thing that stays the same is this mafia-like web on top stays on top. They, like a seal on a turning ball, sort of just manage to stay there. And that, I suppose, is something like the Soviet Union. And as you point out, in the recent decades, the economic boom has accrued to their benefit considerably, politically, I mean, because people that before and even now can't express themselves in politics or religion and so on can express themselves in economic ways. And the Chinese people have done a lot to make a lot of money. Materialism, in a sense, then has taken over as the only publicly approved officially approved public value that people can pursue, and it gets identified with the party state. So that for this younger generation, nationalism becomes almost the public religion. And that's worked.
Well, of course, recently the Chinese Prime Minister, I believe, made some reference to the enormous holdings of U.S. treasuries that the Chinese have, and arguably they subsidize our debt. And this profligate party we've been having here for the last 20 years or so, which right. is now sort of blowing up in our face. So I imagine that signal is not lost on the Chinese people. There's probably a certain amount of pride that this essentially third world country has made such economic strides that the richest country in the world has to borrow from it, which in itself raises a lot of questions.
I think people at the top, and you might say in the middle in China, have that feeling. Among poorer people in China, there's a resentment, and understandably so, that why are we subsidizing the profligate party of a Western nation when we ourselves need health care and we need better schools so that they don't fall down in earthquakes and so on. The amount of discontent at the bottom in China is often overlooked. And one reason it's overlooked is that it is not organized, and it can't be organized because anyone who starts to organize it gets crushed because of the political fear that the rulers have. But there's a lot of discontent at the bottom that people can see with the internet and so on that the rest of the world is doing better and that inequality doesn't have to be this way. And the number of incidents that have become big enough, I call them incidents because the Chinese police do, but big enough that they get measured in the official statistics, has grown by leaps and bounds since about the year 2000. It doubles almost every year. So there's a lot of festering discontent at the bottom about these things.
Well, you mentioned, Dr. Perry-Link, the fear the Chinese government has. It's constantly looking over its shoulder. We in the West often see them as this sort of powerful cabal, which they clearly are. But they also are very, very nervous about that they're riding this tiger at home. And the one thing that communists are most afraid of, paradoxically, of course, and ironically, is a labor movement. You know, the so-called party of the working class
right.
are really afraid of the working class.
Right. There are official unions, of course, and have been since the 1950s, but they're government-organized and controlled unions, and there is a real opposition to workers who make their own unions outside of party rubrics. That happened 20 years ago at Tiananmen briefly, but since then has been crushed, and again, any workers' unions are controlled now. And you're right, there is that paranoia looking over the shoulder. My friend Susan Shirk at the University of California at San Diego has a book that calls China the fragile superpower, and I think that's a good phrase. It is a superpower and is seen from the outside as that, but feels insecure and fragile inside, and partly with reason.
So do you think, just as this country appears to be more and more run by an oligarchy, if you watch what's happening on Wall Street, it's pretty shocking to see the way that this profligate few at the top have caused enormous economic damage for most, and yet the poor taxpayer is bailing them out, and the politicians are clearly in the pocket of the powerful. I mean, I'm not making this up. So here we are. We're talking about China having a similar situation with a powerful elite continually getting powerful. So the final question, Dr. Link, is the enormous discontent in the rural areas and with the 200 million people who are transplanted and living on building sites and uncounted, is there likely to be, I'm holding my breath on the idea of a populist backlash in this country. We seem to have lost our appetite for outrage here. But what about in China?
Well, there could be one. Again, the key in China would be how to organize it. The reason the party was so assiduous in repressing the Falun Gong movement was that that group had an organization of several million people that sort of crept up and formed without the parties noticing it, and then when they noticed it, they panicked. Whether or not that kind of organization or some kind of organization can develop would be the key to whether a populist revolt would actually happen in China. Before you leave, though, I do want to comment on your comparison with the U.S. and China, which is an astute comment, but one thing the West has that China still doesn't is a fairly free press. I mean, here's Ian Masters on the phone talking to Perry Link about these kinds of subversive ideas. You can't do that in China.
Clearly.
The Internet, in a sense, is starting to provide that in China. But all of the major media are publicly controlled, in a sense, or controlled by the party, in a sense that is, we're better off at least in that regard here.
Well, on that cheery note, I thank you so much for joining us this morning in Los Angeles, Dr.
Okay.
Perry Link.
Thanks much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And hello again, I'm Ian Masters. So just speaking then with Dr. Perry Link, formerly professor at Princeton University, now teaches at the University of California, Riverside. While he was at Princeton, he edited the Tiananmen Papers, which were leaked by a high Chinese official, giving the Politburo's insider account of what happened 20 years ago at Tiananmen. And for that, in 1996, China blacklisted Perry Link. He's been denied entrance to China ever since. I'm now speaking with Kirby Dick, who is a Academy Award-nominated documentary filmmaker whose work includes This Film Is Not Yet Rated, Twist of Fate, and Derrida. He is a graduate from the film and video program at the California Institute of the Arts, and his new film is Outrage, which has just opened to rave reviews, and it's described as a searing indictment of the hypocrisy of closeted politicians with appallingly bad records on gay rights voting issues, who have actively campaigned against the community they covertly belong to. And the film reveals the hidden lives of some of America's most powerful policymakers and takes a comprehensive look at the harm that they've inflicted on millions of Americans. The film also examines the media's complicity in keeping this hypocrisy secret. In Outrage, openly gay Democratic Congressman Barney Frank of Massachusetts explains that his Republican colleagues have a right to privacy, but no right to hypocrisy. Kirby Dick, I saw the film yesterday, and in the beginning, you frame it as a conspiracy. So give us a sense of what you see as a conspiracy.
Well, I think it's on a number of levels. I mean, first of all, this is a film about closeted politicians who vote anti-gay. And part of this conspiracy, if you will, concerns the media. The media has really, especially the mainstream media, has really not covered this very extensively at all. In fact, it's the gay press that's been covering it and wanting the mainstream media to cover it. I think there are a number of reasons for that. I think, first of all, the mainstream media is concerned that its readership is mostly straight. They're concerned that perhaps their readership would be turned off or offended by covering a subject that involves gay sexuality. Secondly, a lot of these media outlets are owned by larger corporations that do have a lot of business running through Capitol Hill, and I think they feel that if they in any way offend a powerful legislator, that perhaps that would hurt their bottom line. So the media has not been covering this issue, which is one of the reasons I chose to make a documentary on it.
So, but this is this sort of sickness, if you will, in the body politic that's been going on for a long time in terms of the closeted, mostly Republican officials over the years who have denied their own sexuality, at the same time being cruel in their voting record against the very community that they covertly belong to. And it's created a very, very twisted psychosis here. If you go back, for example, to Roy Cohn, which the film refers to, Roy Cohn and J. Edgar Hoover, who had these secret lives, but were striking out in many ways as Hoover and Cohn together, arguably brought the Republican Party back. After World War II, after the Depression, the Democrats had tremendous plurality in this country. And the way that the Republicans made a comeback was using paranoia, by basically floating this canard. If you're progressive on domestic issues, you're therefore aiding and abetting the Soviet enemy, and they used all of the paranoia about the hydrogen bomb and atomic bomb tests to put the Democrats on the defensive, and arguably they've been on the defensive ever since. And that was largely engineered in secret by these two closeted homosexuals.
Right. No, that's true. And my film, you know, examines the history from then to the present, and in particular focuses on over the last 20 years with the Republican Party and the religious right sort of joining forces and demonizing gays and lesbians, creating this anti-gay hysteria so that they could advance their own political agenda. And what's happened is that in their own party, there were a number of semi-closeted, semi-out politicians who at times, actually, in the 80s and 90s, we've heard would actually go to gay bars, and there was no real issue around that. But what happened is once the Republicans started creating this anti-gay hysteria, they had to go deep inside the closet because they were now concerned that their own constituency might vote them out. And now the problem with being in the closet is this, is that it really torques the political system. These people now feel like they have to vote anti-gay, even if they don't want to, because they're concerned that a pro-gay vote will suggest that they're gay. So the voting records of these closeted politicians is really appalling and has really harmed millions of American gay and lesbian citizens.
But the analogies, I think, between the period that I just mentioned, the McCarthy period, mm-hmm. where you had a phony issue that was ginned up to create paranoia and division,
exactly.
and therefore give the Republican Party plurality. They did the same thing with the gay movement in 2004. Bush goes to the nation and talks about a constitutional amendment, which everybody knows is complete phony, would never happen, but it was used as a tool to divide the country and to demonize a group within the country. And arguably it worked. And in many ways, I see analogies between the Roy Cohn clique that pulled off the McCarthyism back in the 50s and the Karl Rove, Ken Melman clique that pulled off this latest orchestrated paranoia.
No, I think you're absolutely right. I think it's an ever-present strategy of sort of the reactionary forces in this society to use paranoia to maintain power. What's interesting is that you commented on the federal marriage amendment. Is within D.C. There were a lot of gays and lesbians, Republican and Democrat, working behind the scenes to stop that. But because D.C. is such a closed town, and because it's so, people really work behind the scenes. Nobody really wants to come out public. It's very buttoned down. They were unwilling to go public. And what happened is, there's a blogger, Mike Rogers, who we focus on in our film, who started actually this more recent campaign of reporting on the hypocrisy of these closeted politicians, because he knew they were working hand in glove with the president and the people to try to get this federal marriage amendment passed. And as a result, he actually outed two very major politicians, Ed Schrock, a congressman from Virginia, and he outed Larry Craig 9 months before the whole revelations around Larry Craig. So our film profiles that and then moves from there on to looking at other politicians, some of whom are actually still in office.
Well, one of them is, of course, from California here, David Dreier, who's a powerful politician in the Republican Party and apparently a very skillful one.
Yep.
And he was up for the number two leadership post, which he lost. And supposedly he lost it because the religious right weighed in and because of his sexuality, which he denies, even though he lives with his chief of staff and travels with him. The point that I was left with after watching the film, Kirby Dick, was this idea of, you know, why doesn't David Dreier step out? Because I'm sure his constituents would still vote for him because he's apparently a very good representative. And another point that's made in the film is a couple of times towards the end, people say, look, if all these closeted homosexuals in this country just stepped out of the closet, the problem would go away.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, I think this is David Dreier making a political calculation. I think a wrong one, but a very cynical one, that he's going to continue to demonize gays and lesbians in order to try to maintain his position of power within the Republican Party, and also to remain in office. Now,
right, but they just cut him off at the knees.
They did. But you know, I also the other thing is, once these politicians, you know, for 20, 25 years, they've been giving the impression that they're heterosexual. Now I think that they're afraid to come out and say, look, you know, I've really been misleading you. I actually think they're making a mistake. I think their constituency, particularly in his district, which is not particularly Republican. I would say it's split evenly between Democrat and Republican. I think both Democrats and Republicans in his district would say, hey, you know, this is great. He's come out. He's actually telling us the truth, how unusual for any politician in some way. And, you know, he's going to get our vote. But he hasn't. And he's still, you know, even very recently on the hate crimes bill, he voted against it. So, I mean, his appalling record continues.
Well, in contrast, though, you profile Jim Colby of Arizona, Republican congressman of Arizona, who did out himself before he was about to be outed. And then he voted the right way. But he didn't run again, did he, as a gay?
No, actually he did. I think he
did.
Was reelected five times. He's from Arizona.
He got reelected five times after he outed himself?
Exactly.
Well,
exactly.
there's the lesson then, isn't there?
Exactly. And I mean, also personally, it was so rewarding to him. I mean, he described it as when he finally came out, he described it as a near religious experience because he'd had, you know, decades of sort of this lying or sort of living this double life. It was lifted off of his shoulders. And of course, former Governor Jim McGreevy, who came out and said the famous statement, "I am a gay American," in 2004, I believe, also describes that feeling that finally he can live his, you know, live the truth.
Well, the film also chronicles the massive contortions of denial on the part of Charlie Crist, the governor of Florida, who every time he runs for higher political office, he conveniently gets married for a short period of time. And of course, he was slated to be a VP for John McCain. I don't know whether it was the fact that he was gay that cost him that role that went to Sarah Palin, but apparently he's still being considered in some circles as a possible presidential candidate for the Republicans.
Exactly. And I think it was partially that the you know, that's one of the reasons he chose to get married, was he wanted to. There's been many rumors about him in Florida, and he wanted to sort of attempt to put those rumors to bed, so to speak, by getting married. But you know, I mean, again, that's it, you know, to sort of misrepresent yourself to your constituency like that, I think is really appalling. But he's always wanted to be president, and he's always seen the fact that you know, that there's these rumors that he's gay as sort of an impediment. And you know, again, it's like David Dreyer. I think he's made a real mistake here. I actually think, particularly if he hadn't got married, he could have been the first openly gay, serious candidate for the presidential nomination of a major party, maybe in like 2014. I think it was a real mistake on his part. Perhaps he can, you know, finally come out and tell the truth and get to that position still. I don't know.
Well, the one that, of course, who is the really twisted soul, I must say, is Larry Craig. I mean, good Lord. I mean, he's caught red-handed. And of course, the earlier in the 80s, when they had the scandal over the Page Boys, he came up in that. I mean, it's the worst kept secret in Washington, and yet there he goes on ABC before the mainstream press, in one of those pathetic softball interviews with his loyal wife chirping right beside him, talking about, you know, how he could never do that, whatever it is that they do, you know. And then you got in the film, you know, a testament of a guy who went out with him and described the encounter.
Exactly. And there's also Mike Rogers, when he outed him in 2006, also had spoken to someone who'd had sex with Larry Craig in another bathroom, in the Union Station bathroom, which is only about 3-4 blocks from the Capitol. So this is something that I mean, obviously, is the way that he, you know, apparently frequently has sex, and, and yet his wife is standing beside him saying, you know, I stand by my man. I completely believe my husband. But
right. Well, you know, the MacReady, the ex-governor of New Jersey in the film, I thought was very moving in the way that he described how he had to have furtive sex in all kinds of weird places and how soul-destroying it was and how envious he was of his straight friends. And again, you get back to this idea of that there's this ridiculously hypocritical world that's been created. For what purposes? Who's being served by the closet? And then you start to see, through this film of yours, Outrage, you start to see the extent to which the Republican power establishment has had this very sick relationship. And one of the points that the film makes is it's not just these politicians we've been talking about, it's an entire cadre of staffers on the Hill. And I know that for a fact because I spent some time in Washington, that there's enormous network going on there. And it's and if you just remember the guy from military.studs.com who was suddenly able to ask President Bush questions. Jeff Gannon. And then you've got the Club for Growth, which Jeff Gannon used to hang out with, Grover Norquist, and all these networks of people. It's really quite pervasive.
Yeah, it is. It is. And I think when you look at someone like Larry Craig, I mean, as horrid as his voting record is, he's actually also a victim of homophobia. I mean, I'm sure he's someone who would not want to live his life and have sex only in bathrooms. I mean, he's making this choice because he feels it's the safest place to have sex because he feels he wouldn't be identified there in an anonymous sexual encounter. But they're victims as well, and I think that's one of the things that the film looks at. It looks at the psychology of these people who have to live this double life.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, Kirby Dick, and for your new film, Outrage, which I recommend because this is a political, beneath the iceberg, as it will. The press won't touch it. I don't know whether they think that somehow it's unfair to shame people, but as Barney Frank said, you know, Republicans have a right to privacy, but not a right to hypocrisy.
Exactly.
Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. Just speaking there with Kirby Dick, an Academy Award nominated documentary filmmaker. His new film, Outrage, is open to rave reviews. I'd like to thank Louis Vandenberg, the producer, Elliot Fong, the associate producer, Janie Coolidge, the assistant producer, and G, the engineer.